My name is Ken Brecker. I'm the president of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, and we're co-presenting this evening with our newest neighbor on Grand Avenue, the Broad. The Los Angeles Public Library has been on Grand Avenue at 5th and Flower for longer than you may realize. If truth be told, before there were newspapers in Los Angeles, before we had paved roads, before there was electricity in Los Angeles, there was the Los Angeles Public Library. And I'm very happy to report that under the leadership of a great city librarian, John Szabo, a man who loves art and architecture and who is here this evening, our public libraries are flourishing. It may just be that the 21st century will be a new golden age for libraries as well as museums. The public libraries are filled with people, artists, writers, students, and people of all ages and all backgrounds from every community. Everyone is reading. Hardcover books are not going away, but since Gutenberg, technology may be the best thing that ever happened to libraries. People are using the public libraries, thousands of free computers, to learn more, to find new opportunities, to write and to create. Did you know that you can now check out an ebook from home and not have to worry about late fines because it disappears from the device when the loan period is over? If you're wondering why the Broad is presenting this evening with the Library Foundation, the reason may be that the public libraries are the greatest resource for arts and culture in the city of Los Angeles. We have over 4 million photographs in our collection, and we circulate more art books and films than any cultural institution. Whether you are going into our branches in San Pedro or Echo Park, the Pacific Palisades or South Central, from downtown across the San Fernando Valley, we are open 7 days a week, and we are free. The Broad is helping us to usher in this new dawn, and we look forward with great excitement to how together we will transform Grand Avenue, downtown, and perhaps Los Angeles as a whole into our country's most creative and progressive and generous city. And it is now with great pleasure I introduce Joanne Heiler, director and chief curator of the Broad Art Foundation and the founding director of the Broad. Joanne.
Well, thank you, Ken. Welcome to the beautiful Orpheum Theater for this evening's conversation. Part of the Unprivate Collection series of talks with artists produced by The Broad. We're still about a year away from opening The Broad, a new contemporary art museum for Los Angeles. We're under construction less than a mile from here, but we're very, very anxious to share a glimpse of what is to come when we do open our doors with events like tonight. When a contemporary art collection is built, you have a rare opportunity to know the artist as you discover their work. Conversations with artists are a big part of what drew Eli and Edie to collect, and they are also what inspired tonight's talk and the entire Unprivate Collection talk series. They're a way for us to introduce the museum and the collection to you. This talk, the fifth in our series, brings together Jeff Koons, and iconic American filmmaker, author, performer, and artist, John Waters. I take it there's an interest in these two figures. But still, some have asked me why we brought them together to share a stage. Jeff Koons is one of the most well-known artists in the Broad collections, and the Broad Museum will hold his work in unparalleled depth. 33 examples and counting. Some of Jeff's works feature whimsical objects, balloon animals, cartoon characters, and inflatable lobsters. And so we thought, who better to pair with him than someone who's also famous for flaunting conventions, to put it mildly, with great wit and intellectually wide lens. Jeff and John have both been cultural lightning rods for decades now. Jeff has been called the King of Kitsch, and John has had even more monikers. The Pope of Trash, the Sultan of Sleaze, and the Baron of Bad Taste. But in my view, they don't really upend standards of good taste. They each, in their own way, ignore the notion of taste into non-existence. And so, with that in common, we knew that pairing Jeff with John had all the ingredients of a delicious evening filled with, as John might say, shameless integrity. You're in for a treat tonight, maybe even a historic evening, as we present two creative visionaries sharing their unique views of art. Please welcome Jeff Koons and John Waters.
Wow, that was a very presidential debate entrance, wasn't it?
It was great, John. It was great.
I'd kind of like to start at the beginning and ask you a very Freudian question. Did you have a secret art life as a child?
John, when I think in about the very beginning for me, it would have started around the age of three. And I have a sister, I have a sibling, Karen. And Karen's 3 years older, and she could always do everything better than me. She could count higher and pronounce words better. She could do everything. But around three, I remember drawing at a desk and my parents coming up behind me and really kind of patting me on the back and saying, you know, that's fantastic, Jeff. And I finally felt that I could do something better than my sister. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a sense of self. And finally, I kind of had a position in the family. I had something that I could bring, you know, kind of to the table. And that's where it began for me.
And what were you drawing?
I'm sure that it was probably like a sailfish jumping out of the water. In our local newspapers, they would have every Sunday a column called Cappy Dick. Mm-hmm. And Cappy Dick was a sea captain, and they would have these activities for children, and you were to extend that activity. So maybe it would be, you know, a boat, and somebody sitting fishing in a boat, and then you would color that in and cut it out of the newspaper and then glue it down on a piece of paper and enlarge the scene. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I could have been drawing a sailfish jumping out of the water. And so I would enter these contests. I never won first prize, which was an set of encyclopedias. Mm-hmm. But every week I would get the second prize or the third prize.
Was this the How to Draw, that one guy that had the ads, you too can be an artist? Yeah. Remember him?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I would do those drawings too. I enjoyed making those drawings. But that's how it started for me. And I started taking lessons on weekends. When I was 7, 8 years old, every Saturday I would, you know, be taking an art lesson, whether it was from an elderly woman. I'd be down in her basement, and we'd be drawing vases of flowers every Saturday.
But you never drew anything that caused alarm to your parents?
No. I would say that I had, you know, behavior. I had a little wild side when I was younger, and I would get in trouble a little bit. But art was something that I was always pulled to, but I had no idea what it was. And I think in some manner, it created anxiety because I didn't know what this activity could be. And there were a lot of rules, you know. You try to make something look really three-dimensional and very lifelike. And, you know, I was good at that because I had lessons and, you know, I knew how to use light and shading and color. But it didn't seem to answer a question of its own being, like, why exist, you know? Yeah.
But you were ambitious when you were a kid.
I think I started to become ambitious when I heard Led Zeppelin. And, no, but really, when I heard Led Zeppelin, it was kind of a changing moment for me in my life. All of a sudden...
Not art.
No. Mm-hmm. It had been... I learned... My father taught me aesthetics. So, you know, I learned that aesthetics, colors, and textures can affect the way that you feel. Mm-hmm. But I also learned a lot about feeling through Zeppelin. And it ties to... sociology, and that, you know, I wanted more. So I remember, being 16, driving around in my car, listening to Zeppelin, and wanting more, you know, deciding that, okay, you know, I want to get out of here. I want to follow, the things that I'm thinking about. And my friends at the time would kind of think, oh, you know, Jeff, what's he thinking about, these philosophical things, you know? And so I started to become, I would say, somewhat more isolated because I wanted more.
But what was the first artwork that you ever hung on your wall? Even if cut out of a magazine or anything.
That I hung on my wall.
Yeah.
I remember my aunt, Erna. Yeah. It wasn't on my wall, but I remember doing a drawing of a woman, and she had a kind of a hat on her head and a scarf around her neck, and it was a straw hat and a, kind of a ribbon coming around holding it on her head. And I always remembered that, and mm-hmm. I framed it up and I gave it to her one time. I was probably, I would say at the time, maybe 8.
But you never felt alienated by art. I mean, I remember when I first went to the Baltimore Museum and bought a little Miro print and brought it home, all the other kids said, "Oh, that's ugly. Why would you put that ugly thing on your wall?" I thought, the power of art. Yeah. You know, it really made me feel glad that everyone hated it. And as a kid, I used to pretend I was nude descending the staircase, and no one knew. I would come down the steps thinking, moving, you know, only I knew. Yeah. So that's what I meant by a secret art life.
Yeah. You know, I did not have the upbringing of going to museums. My aunt that I mentioned before lived in Philadelphia, and she took me to the Philadelphia Museum. And so she was the first that kind of showed me kind of an urban kind of life in a way, cultural institutions. And it's funny that you mentioned the Baltimore Museum, because I ended up, going to art class all the time in school, and I wasn't really prepared to do anything other than go to art school and be an artist. So I went to the Maryland Institute College of Art, and the first day they took us to the Baltimore Museum. And they put us on a bus, we went there, and when I went into the museum, I realized I did not know anybody. I didn't know who Matisse was, mm-hmm. I didn't know Cézanne. I would have known Picasso, and I would have known Dalí, but that would have been about it. And I feel like I survived that moment. And I feel that, a lot of people don't survive that moment, but somehow I got through that moment. And I ended up, getting back on the bus, going mm-hmm. back to school and having an art history class. And the teacher brought up an image of Manet's Olympia. And he started to talk about the different images and the different symbols that are taking place in the painting. The cat over on the right-hand side, or the bouquet of flowers. And I have to say, I felt like the luckiest person in the room, because I felt like finally... there was a reason for being, that I could be connected, how, art can connect you to all the human disciplines. I could be involved in philosophy that I love. I could be involved with sociology and aspects of theology and aesthetics. And everything just came together. And finally, I understood that art was something that, instead of creating anxiety, was something that removes anxiety.
Well, you were in 1972 at Maryland Institute, and I was making Pink Flamingos in Baltimore at the exact same time. And we never met. Yeah. We never met. Yeah. But were you rebelling then?
Yes, I mean, rebelling in that, you know, I wanted to find my own way in life. And I was interested in transgressive things because I was interested in parameters and feelings and sensations and how they become ideas. So I was interested in kind of self-discovery. The work that I liked, I enjoyed surrealism, Dada, and all of the, and I enjoyed your work, John. I mean, I was following your films. But I was interested in things that I believe were helping me learn to trust in myself, an inward journey, and to develop a sense of personal iconography and a language that I could start to create to affect my own feelings, my own sensations, and then eventually to, you know, be able to do that and affect others.
You know? Well, you know, they always bring up taste when they're talking about you. They always mention good taste and bad taste. And I was drilled in good taste by my family, and that's, I turned it into a career, rebelling from it. But at the same time, you have to know the rules of good taste, and I think your work is in good taste. But if we look at one here, the mirror one, that particular one, there was a furniture store in Baltimore called Stanley's. Did you ever go there?
No, but I'm familiar. I've went outside it.
It was
looked
on
in
Utah
the
Street. Me too.
Sure,
it,
yeah.
We couldn't afford it, but we wanted to make it what Pink Flamingos look like, the inside. And that mirror, I mean, it, Stanley's, I always wondered, did he go shopping there? Because it was a store that was beyond taste. Mm-hmm. And I think both of us never make fun of what we're referencing. I don't think we ever look down and say, this is kitsch, this is bad taste. I think we look up to it because it's a freedom of a certain kind of extreme taste. And I mean, and you took that mirror and took it from that and put it in the, completely turned it around in the same way, but I always thought that you respected that mirror. Mm-hmm. You weren't asking us to look at that mirror and make fun of it in any way. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, and I think we do share, and this is really kind of at the heart of our work, I think we really do share a core. And that core, I think, is acceptance. And I remember when I was young, my grandfather and grandmother, they had a table kind of similar to this in their little library and where they also had the television. And they had a little porcelain figurine. It was a woman lying down, and she was on a couch, and her legs were up in the air, and it was actually an ashtray. And you're supposed to be able to put your cigarette there. And if you put your cigarette there, the smoke was supposed to have the legs go back and forth. But you would really push it back and forth. But, you know, as a young child, I enjoyed that. She was quite sensual.
Yeah.
And it was kind of sexy. And I'm sure that I was kind of a little aroused in some way. Again, this sensation of feeling the sense of porcelain. Mm-hmm. And So that's very important, and I think that experience of enjoying that little ashtray and playing with it, and you know, every time we go to my grandparents' house, running over as soon as I get in the door, to play with that ashtray, that work is as wonderful in its own being as the Pietà, and I can receive as much enjoyment in observing that and interacting than I do, you know, with the Pietà today. So for me, it's about acceptance, and it's about accepting the self and first really accepting the self. But then after you accept the self, you automatically want to go outward and you want to go into the world and you want to interact and you want to increase your parameter. And so you start to work with metaphor in with objects and accepting objects, accepting things for that may be a little bright or economically maybe manufactured in a way that an upper class may not be so attracted to it. And in accepting these things, it's all metaphor for accepting of others.
I agree with that. Do you agree with this statement that I think your work is never funny? I think it is fun, but that's an insult to most artists, but I pay it with great compliments, and always witty. Would you agree with that?
I think that it's optimistic, and I think I try to put a good kind of foot forward in embracing life, and I enjoy life's energy, but I like feelings, and so I like things that feel kind of vast and kind of exciting and, you know, yeah, a sense of future.
Can we go to slide number five? Because I'm wondering, okay, you're at the Institute in Baltimore. You're doing. How did we get from there to this?
You know, I have to say,
because I love this work. And I mean, this work really is it stops you in your tracks, and you feel stupid at first, and then you get smarter by the second as you look at it.
I have to say, that's really very it's sweet, John. It's great, but I really love this work. And so, I was in art school. I was always a painter, and I would win awards for my drawing and my painting. I went to Maryland Institute College of Art. The president of the school gave me a show in his office, and I won a scholarship to Skowhegan. And I didn't go to Skowhegan. I ended up going to Chicago instead to study with the Chicago Images. But I studied there, and I was always painting, and eventually my paintings became so kind of large that I had to take them off the wall. And so I started, and that had me go from being a painter to kind of doing a lot with sculpture. And I also wanted to stop making work that was about more of subjective aspect of what I dreamt the night before, or I really wanted my work to be more objective. And I was looking at work of Robert Smithson, of Robert Morris, a lot of Leo Castelli artists. And so I moved to New York. This would have been end of 76, 77. I started to have this change take place. And the Rapids from 78.
Mm-hmm. And are you? Does it matter to you if viewers are confused or angered by your work?
You know, John, the art happens inside the viewer, and I really would like, you would like to be able to communicate the sensation I get when I look at this piece. I mean, I feel something. I feel kind of a sexual stimulation, and that stimulation.
I'm liberal.
Yeah, but that. That stimulation turns into idea, and so that's. The way the body responds in your heartbeat and the sweating, the different things that the body does responding to stimuli really depends on the context of how you feel, a different type of emotions that you feel. I was very excited about the openness of this and the energy, and I felt that it was being objective, that it was going into more of an archetypal vocabulary.
So it was not innocence to you, this?
Aspects of it, but also there's, for me, a kind of a sophistication that there are parallel dialogues going on. I mean, the carrot to the mouth is like an orator, like I'm speaking right now, microphone, but it also kind of a symbol of masturbation, the carrot.
So, in other words, it's not your devotion to innocence is colored, right? I mean, you seem guiltless in the devotion to innocence. Would you agree with that?
Guiltless in the devotion of it. Well, I'm interested in youth, in how open we are, and how really kind of unjudgmental we can be. That we can, you love blue for blue and pink, pink, and you can you grab an inflatable and you want that to be yours. I just want to mention, John, one of the reasons that the inflatable is so important to me is we're inflatables. You take a breath. You're inflatable. And so they're really a kind of a symbol of optimism,
But can cute, some people think that, is that threatening to you, cute? The word cute is a word that I basically don't like, and you probably don't either. Yeah. You don't like it if somebody says your work is cute, So, and that's maybe the biggest insult you can give, I don't know. But is it threatening? When you do it, sometimes it's almost threatening to me.
What I believe I was starting to play with is affirmation. And so the mirrors behind the rabbit and behind the flower, they are affirming you because it's totally dependent on you. The art needs you. When you move, the abstraction changes, the reflection changes. And so it's affirming the existence of the viewer and that everything's happening inside them. These things are just very stimulating, but the art's inside them.
But childhood is a huge, you have six children, childhood is very important, I think, in your work. But is menace always lurking near childhood?
I have a total of eight children.
You have eight?
Total.
Okay.
I have six young ones right now. But I would say what's menacing for me is to not exercise freedom, you know, mm-hmm. to waste an opportunity. And we all have this opportunity every moment of our lives to exercise the freedom that we have to really experience enlightenment, to experience the vastness of the possibilities of what our experience of life can be and the revelation of those possibilities to ourselves.
Well, I mean, let's look at the one, number 13, the caterpillar in the ladder. To me, that's threatening. I don't know, everybody knows you don't walk under a ladder.
you know, John mentioned the nude descending the staircase, but that was my nude descending the staircase.
I can see that, yeah. But I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm always wondering if underneath there lurking is the danger of childhood. Okay. And of course it is dangerous to have a child. Anything can happen. But so when you look at this work, is like number 12, that's another one. To me, that's scary. That reminds me of a playroom in a prison when you visit people. And they always look in this other room where the children are supposed to play when they're visiting their parents and have a life sentence. It's a joyless place. And I always look in that little room and no one's in there, no children or anything. And so maybe, can you look at your work and like it in the wrong way? Maybe I am.
No. You know, absolutely. The way you view something, I mean, it's perfect. And everybody, whatever experiences you have in life, your interpretations of something, your experience, the art that you're feeling, that's perfect. And that's what you should experience. That's about your parameters and your expansion, John. I would say that when I made those works and I had objects going through other objects, for me, I was going through a moment in my life where I had one of my children abducted, a parental abduction, and I was trying to get them back, and I felt that I was experiencing kind of a sense of injustice. And I used my art to get through this type period. So it happened during celebration and also still going on during my Popeye series. So it was about going through things in life but not having it deter your course and to be able to kind of maintain your same course. Those objects are exactly 50% kind of inside the chain link fence. Mm-hmm. And they function a little bit like Rorschach's too, the inside of where the, you know, the inside of the hippo where you have those two holes is kind of like a pelvis area, and the same with up in the turtle.
Can we look at number 9? The word new, I think, has always been very important to you. Do you feel pressure to still always be new, like the vacuum cleaners inside those cases?
The new for me, came about, I wanted to add to, you know, hopefully I wanted to contribute to kind of the Duchampian history of the ready-made. And I was working at the Museum of Modern Art, and I was visiting the architectural design department all the time and, you know, studying a lot of films on Dada. So I decided that to show kind of a very ephemeral, kind of ethereal aspect of these objects, their newness, to try to bring that forth and make it kind of visual. And so I started to encase them, and I would remove them from their environment. And these are vacuum cleaners. So again, they're anthropomorphic for human beings. They're breathing machines, and they have kind of sexual orifices. So it's to relate to kind of the tension that we have between inanimate objects. Of who's really better prepared to survive, whether it's an inanimate object that can just display its integrity of birth, or if it's a biological aspect that we develop our integrity through interactions.
Well, as I said before, sometimes your work, when you first saw those vacuum cleaners, a lot of people were struck dumb by it. They didn't know how to take it. But then once they thought about it, you made them feel new too, I think, which I think is very important. But is new, is it tinged with nostalgia? The new that you were celebrating there?
I know that the news started to, I felt that the way people were responding to it, maybe looked at it a little bit in kind of the 50s, of maybe the housewife in the 50s. And I go on and I create a series after the new called Equilibrium that I thought was more of a masculine view of maybe consumerism. It used more sports colors and objects. And it actually turned out to be even more biological. Like an equilibrium tank where a basketball is just kind of hovering in the tank. It's like an embryo in the womb. It's there and all forces are equal and it's just hovering, but it's very biological.
And sex is, you're talking about sex in your work a lot that maybe people wouldn't have immediately seen it. Is sex art power?
It's feeling. And it's sensation, it's pleasurable, and it helps communicate ideas. I mean, the human body responding to situations creates ideas.
I remember when I went to the Made in Heaven show in Soho, and I went through it, and it was like a rock star show. There were lines all the way down Broadway. It was amazing. First time I'd ever really seen that in an art show. And some of the work in there was absolutely amazing, but yet you've destroyed some of it. Correct?
I was in a custody case. So my ex-wife was kind of trying to bring the work to the level of basically pornography in the eyes of the court. And I was trying to gain custody of my son. So my artist proofs I destroyed. But, you know, I enjoy the work. I love the paintings. I love Manet. I love Glass Dildo. Ilona's Asshole is kind of my Courbet origins of the world. But I enjoy the work. I think pieces like Bourgeois Bust, in a kind of very romantic way, kind of show, you know, the underlying kind of theme of kind of love and the broke and the different tensions of the eternal, of the different ways of entering into the realm of the eternal. You have the biological realm, you have the realm of ideas, playing off kind of the more traditional realm that's presented by religions, you know.
So if we could look at 19 at the big balloon dog. Now, is this sexual? Because basically, the dog's neutered. I mean, the only way it's going to reproduce is on a plate. A limited edition one.
Yeah. But, you know, I look at the tail, and I always think the tail's kind of a symbol of male energy. And I've also always thought that the balloon dog, it's a little bit like a Trojan horse, you know, and it's reminds me of another type of Trojan, too, that you could use to make the balloon dog. But I think of it as quite kind of masculine in a way, kind of male energy.
You know? But it's cleaned up. I mean, this dog can't shit. You know, nobody's going to follow it around with a newspaper bag, you know. It can't have sex. It's neutered in a way, in a great way. So is it manufactured perfection?
John,
which would be good.
Yeah, when I said that it's masculine, I think the front of it, I think that the nose kind of has a masculine aspect in the tail. But if you look at the legs are very feminine. And it's really feminine form. So it's still prepared to have sex.
Well, let's look at a sexual one, number three. So this one, you know, really, I'm against people riding dolphins. Get your lard ass off those things in your bullshit spirituality, you know? However, how do you feel about that?
The inflatables. Whenever I would visit my mother lives in Florida. Usually, I would come home with an artwork, and whether it be I would see like a lobster inflatable or seeing a dolphin inflatable. But to me, when I made an image like this, this is a painting. It was like creating kind of a contemporary Aphrodite and riding a dolphin. And then the Popeyes in the background also kind of remind me of my father's generation of the way of kind of viewing the world and aspect of power, and also the power of art, the transformation that art can bring about, just like, you know, Popeye's spinach brings about that transformation.
And let's look at 18, which to me is your scariest work, and one that... Does Bubbles know the truth? A jury is thought one way. Does Bubbles know differently? That third arm.
You know, actually, the one leg is kind of buried underneath the, there's like a blanket there. But this piece always reminds me a little bit of King Tut. And there's aspect of the Egyptian, even the way that Michael's in the gold and the white and the way he would put the, had his eyes tattooed. But there's Egyptian quality. And even if you look, it's a little bit like the pyramids of Giza, where you have like the line in his leg right there, and then you have Bubbles, and then you have Michael on his arm. And it, so it's making reference to King Tut and the monuments of Egypt, but then also this is the Pieta. And it's having a reference with the Pieta.
Well, you talked about power a little bit. Well, Mr. Broad has your rabbit in his home. That's power, right? I mean, are you comfortable with that, with the power you have? Because you wear it well.
Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, you know, different times of the year, people really enjoy celebrating the holidays. So at Easter, a lot of people will put inflatable rabbits out in their yards. And so when I started to work with ready-made objects, and this would have been back in 1977, 78, you know, the rabbit's one of the first images. The Broad has my first one, the inflatable that we looked at with the flowers, the first inflatable rabbit. And the Broad also has this rabbit. But when I would look at it, it reminds me of, as I mentioned before, like an orator or a Playboy bunny, or you think of resurrection. There's many different ways you can view it. And I think that's what kind of gives it kind of an iconic type of power, in that it can have a lot of different meanings to different people, but it affirms everyone. Anybody looking at it, it first is affirming you. It's telling you that you exist, you're important, everything that's happening here is happening inside you.
Well, I always look at it and feel shameless integrity when I see it, which is power. And this is, why do you think this piece is so iconic of all the work you've done? Why do you think if somebody had to pick one piece, they'd probably pick this one, the most widely known? Why do you think that is?
You know, there are a lot of different reasons that go into these things. Media goes into it, different articles that took place. I mean, it's based on some of my very early inflatables that I worked with. And because of, again, the many different readings that people can look at it and have, it can have a lot of different meanings.
And the celebrity aspect, when you talked about, you know, whether you like it or not, you are a celebrity, and they say that you're the heir to Warhol. How do you feel about that compliment, which people give you a lot?
I'm always honored. I mean, first of all, Andy is an amazing artist, and I've always just wanted to participate. So from the time when I was telling you before, like, you know, at three, I wanted to participate in my family, you know, at seven, in the, you know, whoever I was taking lessons with, and, you know, I wanted to participate with the avant-garde. So I've always have wanted to participate. I would like to exercise the freedom that I have as an artist. That's what I want to do every day. So it's just the meanings of whether I'm associated with Andy or not, it really ends up to be meaningless. It's about what I do in my studio and to what potential I live my art, you know, my artistic life, my life to.
And so you are a brand, you have to admit, whether you like it or not. But can too much of that attention, you know, is the fact that your price, the prices are so high for your work, is, can people look at your work fresh now with that in the news all the time of how much artwork goes for and record-breaking prices and everything? Does that make it harder to feel new?
You know, I have to say, John, I prefer it that way than...
I get it, yeah.
No, but I think that, you know, I try to always make things and to make the work accessible. You know, one of the reasons of being here this evening is, you know, helping support the Broad, which is helping, you know, these works are very, very public. It's a private collection, but it's open to the public, so people are interacting with it. I enjoy being here to talk about the work, and I try to make things that are accessible. I mean, it's about ideas. And, you know, you look at it, and if you get it, you carry it with you for the rest of your life. It's about a philosophy, you know. It's about acceptance, and it's about not making judgments, and about having everything work in your favor instead of alienating things from you and alienating all the possibility to have everything in play and that you can use it and work with it. It's about that, and it's an idea. And there's no value. Actually, I feel a little sorry sometimes for Eli Needy, because they take on the responsibility of taking care of these things. You know, collecting is a responsibility. And it costs a lot of money, it costs a lot of dedication to take care of things. When, you know, the public is able to just get the idea, and they don't always have to take on that responsibility of caring, protecting, and hoping, you know, to try to share it with others.
Do you think you could ever work small again?
I do. You know, I made a Gazing Ball show. That's another reason I think that people enjoy the rabbit that was just there, because the head is really a gazing ball.
Let's do the gazing ball number 14.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, you got it up here, sorry.
Okay, this is a gazing ball piece. And so the ball that's on Hercules' shoulders, the Farnese Hercules, that's the same as the head of the rabbit. And you know, people know from just in the back of their mind that they've seen them in people's gardens. They've seen it in very accessible places. So the work is always telling you about the accessibility, that everything's accessible, everything's here. It's all at your fingertips. Just open yourself to it.
Well, the gazing ball is the first shot in Pink Flamingos, too. They were always right next to a pink flamingo in a lawn, a gazing ball.
Yeah.
So when I saw that, I thought we were in the same. You know, it's a funny story, but Jeff's aunt and my mom, who unfortunately they both just died very recently, were in a very fancy retirement community together. And they would sit and gossip. You think that's bad? You should have been at the Made in Heaven show. Yeah, I was at the Female Trouble opening. They would trade stories about what it was like, and I thought that was so great. And they were like, ha ha ha, you know. But they would just trade horror stories of when we were young and being startled by our work.
They love to play bridge together.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
This was, by the way, the aunt that took me to my first museum.
Yeah. Well, my parents supported too. Like, I wanted to go to junkyards as a child, and my parents would take me to junkyards, and I'd walk around like a little ghoul, say, there's been a terrible accident here. And my parents would allow that, you know, and they, because they didn't know what else to do. It didn't say what to do in the baby book, you know. If your child is obsessed by car accidents, what do you do? So we both had good parents that encouraged us, right? But now, I must admit, I was perplexed by your Croods thing for the Disney, the full-page thing that you wrote about it. I was surprised by that. You did startle me. Was that part of your art career?
No, it wasn't. Well, I would say that was part of my appreciation of things. So Jeffrey Katzenberger and Harvey Weinstein thought that it would be interesting that if I would see the film. Mm-hmm. And I saw the film, and I was with my family, and I thought that it was great. So I wrote Jeffrey a letter and just telling him what I enjoyed about the film. And I enjoyed how it was giving people insight into Plato's philosophy. And it was, you know, based in enlightenment and of, you know, being in the cave and freeing oneself from the cave and going into the light, into enlightenment.
So. But did you know it was going to be a full-page ad in the New York Times?
No.
Well, they asked you, right?
No, well, after they asked me later, after the fact, and I said...
After they published it?
No, but after I wrote the letter.
Right. And how did the Lady Gaga thing happen?
Lady Gaga, I met her maybe about, I would say, 5 years ago. She performed at the Metropolitan Museum, and afterwards I was with Mucha Prada at a table, and she came up and she was talking to Mucha, and I was introduced to her, and she just grabbed me, gave me a big hug. It was fantastic. And she was telling me that she's such a fan that she used to smoke a lot of pot in Central Park and just talk to her friends about my work. And so that's great. But then she ended up, when she got involved with Art Pop, she contacted me later and asked if I would do the album cover. And I have to say, she's a wonderful woman, really creative person, and has a great heart, really loves her public and loves communicating and trying to, you know, share ideas of art and of empowerment with her fans and with people.
And are you a collector today?
You know, the only thing I know is art, and so you know, I love art, and I interact with art that's really from a different kind of generation. It lets me kind of feel to be in contact with other artists and kind of this other kind of family, an extended family. So so I collect some things.
Yeah. And back to Lady Gaga, do you smoke pot?
No.
You never did?
No, I mean, of course I tried things, you know.
Did you try LSD?
You know.
Sorry to put you on the spot. I know you got kids,
yeah,
right?
But, you know, I was younger and I was a wild kid. And I ended up more than those type things. I drank beer. I drank a lot of beer. But
were you ever arrested?
No. For, well, drinking beer, no.
I was once at the Carlin's Drive-In. Yeah. It was really embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we look at number 10? So I think it's, you know, some people say, oh, well, his staff does some of the work and everything. Well, so what, it seems to me. I mean, but if you think it up, is it conceptual art?
Well, you know, I mean, I believe that I do everything. Now, I work with a lot of people, and it started working with a foundry. And when you cast things, every artist, go to a foundry, you bring an object, a model, they take it from you. They'll put it into a wax, you come back, you will make improvements to things, and they'll put it in metal, you come back, and you'll say, can you do this or that? So there's a sense that it's leaving your control, but yet you're controlling it from a distance. So when I started with my first bronzes, I had that experience. But when you create systems of control, it's like, you know, articulating your finger. Like if your mind, you know, you want to pick up a brush and you want to take it here and sweep it around with a little orange here and then go like this and then pick up a little white and blend it in between. It's really no different than doing that with somebody else, in that if you create the system where they know exactly where that swirls to be and right here and exactly how that's to blend. So it's a way, I wanted distance because I was scared in my more of my youth, in my past, of being too physically involved. I came from a very Duchampian background that I felt that if I was physically involved and if I wanted to create a swan, I could start off to create a swan but end up creating a pig or a duck. And by having the distance, I could always stay in control that it's a swan and that it would be exactly the way I wanted. Now, I have to say that I've, in life, and a lot through the understanding of Picasso's work, I've kind of come full circle, and my whole idea, the objective, has really changed. And it's like the yin and the yang, and it's a complete full circle. And so whether you are physically involved or not physically involved, it's a full circle.
If we can look at number two. So I understand how when I'm thinking up a movie or writing a book, how the ideas begin. How did that begin? How do you first say, okay, what is the very first time you thought what this is going to be? How did that start?
Anthony Dufay, an art dealer in London, every year would ask me to make a calendar for him.
And make a what?
A calendar for his gallery. And he would send out a calendar every year to his clients. And I was showing with Anthony, and every year I would never get around to doing it. So he really pressured me one year, and I said, okay, I'll do it. So I got a very large camera, format camera, and I started photographing objects. And so I made these balloon tulips and put them on Mylar backgrounds and photographed it. And I created a painting out of that. I ended up creating the sculpture based on that.
So this was a painting first?
Well, the images, I was started off making a calendar. My whole celebration series was really laid out as a calendar. And I realized, wait a minute, this is too good. I have a whole body of work here. And so Anthony never got his calendar. But, you know, so the, you know, tulips are, it's like an underlying of spring, or my hanging heart's a little bit like Valentine's Day, or there's aspect of romance. It could also be something tied to more of a theological aspect, or, you know, they're different images. Bread with egg could be something maybe around Easter, or maybe another time of the year, depending on someone's background. But so there's this aspect of a cyclical year that's taking place.
And positive, I mean, I have not heard you say a negative word tonight, which is very rare for an artist, to hear an artist talk about anything without anything being said negative. So should we believe you?
I think that I did speak negative. And when I spoke negative was when I spoke about kind of exercised freedom, of not exercising one's freedom. To me, that's kind of like showing a dark side. That's what you don't want to do, that you want to exercise that freedom. And so I'm always, you know, trying to wake up each day and kind of pinch myself to try to do that, not to go into the dark.
Can we look at number six? So, the party hat. Now, this is one, you know, a very optimistic piece, it feels. But when I look at it, I always wonder who deserves to wear this hat. You know, are children always in danger? You know, I guess I'm thinking negative sometimes. And only because I'm saying it's so cheerful that it hurts almost.
Yeah. Well, you know, that hat, my son Ludwig, this was a half year birthday little party I had for him at home. He was 18 months and he wore that hat and he was abducted the next day.
Oh, yeah. So I'm right. There is something scary about this picture.
Well, but it's, you know, trying to grab a hold of something. I had to maintain a faith in humanity. And I had to just, and through my art, I was able to maintain that, to constantly believe in humanity when I was really losing, you know, my trust in humanity.
Well, I understand that. I mean, because without the outlet I had in all my movies, all the antisocial acts, if I had done them all, I would have gotten the death penalty. So we basically, what would have happened if you didn't have success? Yeah. What do you think, if you had to have had another career? Let's say this didn't work, and something has to work to be a certain age to still do it. What would you have done?
You know, John, I was brought up by my parents and my grandparents to be very self-reliant. So really from a young age, I would go door to door. I'd sell gift wrapping paper. I would sell chocolates. You know, I worked after school as a busboy. I worked at gas stations pumping gas. So, I enjoyed, first of all, taking care of myself.
Well, those are all salesman jobs.
Well, I mean, not pumping gas.
No, not pumping gas.
And not busboying.
Except you're in L.A. working in that one gas station.
But I think that sales is really interesting because it's the front line of morality. Mm-hmm. And
wait a minute, say that again.
It's the front line of morality.
Sales is?
Yeah.
That's a pull quote.
No, yeah. But... And I enjoyed it so much because as a child, I would go and you'd ring somebody's doorbell and you never knew who would open that door. You didn't know what they were going to look like. You didn't know what odor was going to come out of the home.
I had a job once doing Gallup surveys, going door to door, but no one would ever let me in the house. They'd open the door and slam it in my face because I looked so crazy. So I made them all up. And it took an hour to do each interview. So that was my character development. You know, I had to be a housewife. Every day I had to do six and seven of them.
That's great.
And that was the only job I ever had, really. So that's were successful at it. They wouldn't let me in.
No, that's great. Well, you were successful at it, too. I mean,
no, it was a different way. I used it a different way. Did you ever see that movie, Door to Door Maniac, with Johnny Cash?
Yeah.
It's an obscure one. Yeah. Let's look at number four. Yeah. So, what was your religious? You weren't Catholic, were you?
No.
Yeah.
When I was younger, I was brought up Lutheran, but my parents really didn't participate that much. So occasionally, we would go to church on holidays like Easter or Christmas sometimes, but we weren't strict or really involved deeply.
So you really say that there is no irony in your work, right?
Well, in John, in a piece like this, I was trying to show the way the church has used different materials, the way it's used art, and also the way kings and monarchs and how art's been used. And that now, you know, a lot of things have become completely democratized, and the materials have become democratized. Porcelain came right from the king's kitchen. This is made out of porcelain. And I was trying to, in the body of work banality, let people know that whatever they respond to, it's perfect, it's fantastic. You know, if you respond to a pig, you know, great. If you respond to a penguin, fantastic. It doesn't matter. If you love banal images, if I'd have a watermelon on my head right now, balancing it and playing a trombone, if that's what you like, great. And it's about not feeling inferior to culture or to taste, and that accepting your own history, and that the history is perfect. Everything's about this moment forward, and as soon as you accept yourself, then you can start to have transcendence outward.
Because you look, of course, I look at it so perversely. I look at this symbol. That's what the Manson family did, one in Charlie. You know, and I know that you didn't have that in mind. But people can read all sorts of things in that. But don't you encourage that, really?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm making reference to Leonardo's St. John. And Leonardo, there's also another artist that Leonardo was referencing. So there are a lot of references that are taking place. But the interpretations, you have to have a lot of different interpretations looking at something like that. So I'm not trying to control that completely. I think I'm trying to control certain sensations, certain the way the body responds a little bit to it. I would like kind of certain things to happen, so there's a sense of idea happening.
I loved when you did the show in Versailles. I thought that was the perfect matching. And was that for you like a dream come true to be able to go through Versailles and put work in there?
It was great. I had a friend, I still have a friend, Jérôme de Dormont in Paris, and he's a gallery dealer. And he would always say, you know, Jeff, you should show at Versailles. And I would say, oh, yeah, sure, great, you know, let's do it. But he was able to speak to people, and before we knew it, some of our friends were in positions where it was able to happen. And it was fantastic. And I made the choices for the exhibition, what I showed, very intuitively. And it really felt like being the court artist during the exhibition.
I know that you still have a farm that's not that far from Baltimore, and you go back there some. Have you seen the housing development of garden apartments in Baltimore called Versailles? There really is one. It's staggering. Wow. It's staggering. Wow. It has the big sign, Versailles, and it's like one-bedroom unit garden apartments. You've got to go see it. Yeah. It's really great. Yeah.
Be great.
Let's look at number seven. Yeah. So, in a way, no, not number seven.
You know, thing can I just...
Do you feel there's ugly, is anything in your work ugly? I don't feel that you feel that. Yeah.
You know, I just want to jump back, if I can, just for a second, about Versailles. And it's Louis XIV, Louis XIV. You know, Versailles was this meeting place where everybody was welcome. You know, you could enter the halls of Versailles 24 hours a day. I mean, everybody was welcome. They brought things from all over the world, any new exotic thing or ideas or everything. It was absolute place of collection of ideas and openness. And that's really what I loved about Versailles and interacting in that environment. And that, and connecting to this time, and this is where ideas really blossom from. So.
Okay, so back to ugly. Mm-hmm. Is there anything ugly in your work?
You have to be able to show something which is optimistic. You have to have a little pessimism in there somewhere to be able to show how kind of bright something can be. It's like if you have white, if you just have white. A piece of white paper here, and you look, it's white. You need another piece of white paper that's even brighter to show, you know, how white it actually is. So I think that sometimes the interiors can be dark, like the balloon dog. there's a darkness on the inside, and through because of the transparent coloring that's there, you look through the coloring into the steel, that the deeper you go, the darker it gets.
But not ugly.
I don't think that it's ugly. I think that there are moments where you see into the darker side of things, that you feel certain tensions, and that you understand that there are different forks in the road.
Have you ever thought of making a movie?
I did, and I'm glad that I didn't, though.
Which one?
Made in Heaven.
Oh, yeah. That was a movie?
Well, it wasn't a movie, but I thought about making a movie.
Oh, but you didn't. Oh, yeah.
I did.
Oh, you've done
it.
The porn movie, right?
Yeah,
that would have been great.
Yeah.
I would have been for that.
I made the billboard for it.
I remember that.
The billboard for it. But I knew, I was listening to myself. I wish I would have listened even closer intuitively. But I really didn't want to do it. I didn't want to make the film. And I've always felt that I have enough on my plate just dealing with the mediums of, the two-dimensional realm of painting and three-dimensional of sculpture right now, that this is an area that I have enough involvement in.
So you're not thinking of not making a porn movie, but to go back to make any kind, even video art?
Well, I couldn't say that. I mean, maybe there would be an opportunity sometime where something would seem to be correct, that could be interesting. But
so tell us a little bit I haven't seen yet Big Heart you just did, the giant heart.
Well, I made that was part of the celebration work.
Well, it was, but hasn't it just been installed?
That piece came from my own collection, but one was installed at Crystal Bridges.
That's what I'm talking about.
So that is part of the celebration series. I was walking down, I think, Lexington Avenue, and I saw this plastic heart with a gold ribbon just in this pharmacy. And I went in, I said, I'll give you $5 for that heart. Mm-hmm. And they sold it to me. And I went back, I photographed it for this calendar. And it's the hanging heart.
Do you feel pressure, to top yourself, to keep going? What's next? What's next? What's next? Isn't that pressure?
No.
It's not?
No. Because for me, it's about exercising freedom. It's about that opportunity. And that's what I want to do with my life. I want to experience the vastness. I always think about kind of the moment of death, that, maybe right at that moment, there's a sense of consciousness of just how easy, and everything would be made so clear, and that everything would present itself was just there. And, I don't want that moment that, all of a sudden if I only would have done that. Oh, it would have been so easy. I could have made the most incredible thing. And, but I want to experience that today, not at that moment of death, if this moment of enlightenment would happen like that. And I've thought a lot about the artistic process of what one does. And I really believe the only thing that you can do is trust in yourself, follow your interests, and focus on those interests. And if you do, it takes you to a very metaphysical place.
Do you believe there's death in your work, in the work that we've seen all tonight on these slides? Is that referenced?
They're all dead. Life is only, a biological thing that happens inside us. The art happens inside us. They're dead. The only exciting thing that to me is to try to experience an enlightenment, to get a greater understanding of the potential and to live that potential.
And how do you read your reviews still or ever?
I will look at things that are in print in a small way, but I don't read essays or anything like that.
But when it started, did bad reviews help? They made my career.
I was always disappointed. I would think, they don't understand. I remember somebody writing that my work was immoral, and they were writing about the aqualung and lifeboat, and I thought, these are all symbols to me in the Equilibrium show about kind of morality, and I was kind of saying that the art world is kind of not being moral, and that's about going for it.
But what did they mean? Because the lifeboat would have sunk.
Well, yeah, the lifeboat would have gone down. But no, but they were just responding that kind of immoral. The same thing still happens a lot in the way people respond to things. But no, it doesn't bother me. You develop kind of a Teflon coating, and maybe for a moment something will bother me, but within a day, it's kind of like it never happened.
I always said to read the good ones twice, the bad ones once, and put them all away and never look at them again. It's the best. Yeah. Well, I think we're with our time limit now. What we'd like to do, people have been tweeting and sending in questions from the audience all night. So we're going to look here and see what questions people have from you. Wow. Okay. What is greater, truthful work or giving the audience what they want? Or are they equal?
What is greater? I mean, I would...
You'd like me to repeat that?
Yeah, well, I think I kind of understand
okay.
it. But it would mean, you know, what a truthful work would mean. I mean, I would interpret that to be the greater in that, you know, you're just making a work. If somebody will present me with an opportunity, and this happens a lot with charities, you know, we would like you to make something, and you want to do it for the charity, but, you know, here's a shoe. Make a piece of art out of it. That's not the foundation of art. That's design. And the only thing I can kind of do is probably end up with a design object here, where art is something that has absolutely nothing's connected to it. There's no demand from the beginning. It's just anything you want to do. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to do is just what I want to do. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to say that I can live in a trailer and I can buy all the beer I want. And I can do what I want to do the rest of my life. So I think I'm doing what I want to do.
I think you've reached, I always said success was two things. You could buy every book you wanted without looking at the price, and you never have to be around assholes. And you've reached that.
Yeah.
We both reached that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why is it important to make art free to the public? And maybe he doesn't think that's the right answer either.
No, it's great. No, it, you know... art's always fantastic, and the reason it's important is we all, you know, benefit from experiencing transcendence. And I think as soon as anybody learns to kind of take care of themselves and able to be self-sufficient, automatically they want to do that for the community. And so I think every individual, I think this is throughout history, that people want to kind of better their situation, they want to experience, and then automatically you want to share that. And art is in that dialogue. Everybody in the art world, the reason they're there is they first of all appreciate the community, they appreciate each other, and they appreciate you know, the experience they have from art and sharing that kind of interest and that transcendence with each other.
But Jeff, don't you sometime enjoy the elitism of the art world? I do. I think art for the people is a terrible idea.
No. You know, I think, that's good. I mean, everything has its place. I mean, that's one of the reasons, like, I embrace, like, the Made in Heaven work. When I made Made in Heaven, you know, today the world's changed a lot. I mean, it's nothing. You can pick up a pop album and the language is very strong or images are very strong. But, you know, everything has its place and there are different audiences for everything. And if somebody can absorb something and they have interest in it, it's fantastic. I mean, I don't see any separations. It's all about, you know, going, if something grabs your interest, you go with it. If it doesn't, you look somewhere else.
Yeah. But you don't get angry at the very unsophisticated, oh, my kid could do that. Well, your kid couldn't do that, but their kid could like that, which is radical, really, to say that your child could like art is to some artists would make them nervous.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very happy that maybe their children would have interest in the work. And,
yeah.
So no, that type of dialogue doesn't bother me. I guess I'm kind of looking, John, a little bit at a big picture, because I really would like to have a dialogue, and I'd still like to do something. I still feel like I haven't done something yet, and I'd like to do something.
All right. For Jeff and John, are there any writers or literary figures that inspire you?
Which figures? These literary
figures that inspire you.
Well, philosophically, I mean, I like Plato, you know, and I've always enjoyed Kierkegaard. In contemporary time, I mean, I enjoy reading about science. I like Steven Pinker, you know. That's what
not for your art. It didn't really end up in your artwork.
No, I mean, these things do. I mean, when I read, usually any body of work, if there's something I'm involved with and really kind of focusing on it, it stimulates you and you end up incorporating aspects of it into your work.
I think to answer the person's question, I think Denton Welsh and Jane Bowles were the two that I loved the most that were novelists. What's your opinion of the booming art market and skyrocketing prices? Boy, I bet you've never had that question.
Yeah, that's... you know, I'd have to say that it was something that I never anticipated as an artist. I got involved with art, you know, never anticipating whether I could make a living doing this or not. Again, I just wanted to participate. And I always would have been happy, again, as I mentioned, of just being able to have the freedom just to live my life and to follow my interests the way I wanted to. I think that art is touching a lot of people because there's so many different opportunities of through technology and access. You know, people say, "Oh, art's you know, removed from the people. It's so expensive. Nobody can have art." I mean, people have more art than ever. We have the internet. I mean, I just before coming to this talk, I was looking at Picasso's work. I was going to different museums on the internet. I mean, you can print things out. There's so many images. And so we have more connection with art than ever and can experience art without travel and do all these things. So we're closer to art than ever. You know?
And this, what would Divine have to say about Jeff Koons? Well, he would be mad that you did Lady Gaga's album and not his. let me see. One of those reasons. When did you each encounter each other's work? I think the first show that I saw of yours was The Vacuum Cleaners, and the new show. And where was that? Was in Soho?
Yes. Yeah. First time was probably Artist Space.
That's where I saw it. Yeah. And you probably maybe saw the movies in Baltimore.
Pink Flamingos. Yeah. And it was fantastic.
Why do people go to museums? I don't know if that's a snotty question or not. For the lunchroom?
Yeah. You know, what I think is really wonderful about a museum is a sense of human history. And, you know, it's like going to a natural history museum. I have kind of the same type of sensations of learning about human history, of what it feels like to be a human being, and what's important to us as human beings, and about our mortality, and how, yes, you can live for a brief period of time and still have a connection with human history that's both before you existed and after you're gone.
Can you think of a time when you saw an artist's works influenced by yours, and were you pleased with the outcome?
You know, I'm always honored if I see anybody in any way making some type of reference.
You do see it. You feel sometimes like, well, they stole that.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that they stole that. I'll maybe say to my wife, oh, you know, honey, look, this kind of reminds me a little bit of a gazing ball, or somebody's referencing that. But you know, that's exciting, because with my own work, I'm referencing so many different artists, and to me, it's like a family. It's like taking a thread and stringing popcorn on the thread, you know.
All right, I think I'll close it because I think we've done our 15 minutes of questions. This is a very grand question. What major life events have influenced your work?
Yeah. You know, I'd have to say...
Birth.
Yeah. That's good.
Yes.
John, I would have to say for myself, seeing the Jim Nutt show in New York at the Whitney in 1974, and Jim Nutt is a Chicago artist, Chicago imagist, and it was a type of work that was very kind of subjective about kind of the self, and it was parallel pop art. The work was from the 60s, so parallel kind of New York pop. But it was a little more based in Dada and Surrealism. And yet, you know, Jim Nutt today, too, is a very objective artist. And you look at these pieces, which maybe on the surface seem like, oh, it's very subjective to Jim. And he's making references to Giotto and, you know, all different artists and Picasso and so many different references that are taking place.
Good.
So I'd say Jim Nutt.
Well, Jeff, it's been an honor to have you here tonight and to see you again.
And
thank you very much for coming. Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.